This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The Friday Pitch-In is where we collect a few segments from around the state that are really fun and timely, but we probably couldn't do a whole show about them. Coming up, we'll hear about the 50th anniversary commemoration of the moratorium to end the war in Vietnam. That's actually happening this afternoon at Ball State's Student Center. And later, we'll have some fun with author Ashley Petrie, whose new book, Secret Indianapolis, looks at some really fun, forgotten history that took place here in the capital city and some of the weirder landmarks that you can visit around town. But first, we'll start off the Friday Pitch-In, as we always do, with our fabulous, well-informed, and impeccably dressed digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Matt.
You're here to fill us in on the biggest Indiana stories of the week, and I understand we have another Democratic gubernatorial candidate to talk about.
Yes, we do. Eddie Melton has joined the gubernatorial landscape to run for the Democratic nomination. He's the third candidate. The first one to announce was former State Health Commissioner Woody Myers, and the second was tech CEO Josh Owens. Eddie Melton announced on Tuesday in his hometown of Gary, Indiana, that he was going to run. He put together an exploratory committee much earlier this year and then went on a series of listening sessions along with State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick.
What do we know about Eddie Melton? He's from Gary.
Yeah, he's from Gary. He's a state senator from Gary. He previously served on the State Board of Education, and he's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Elections Committee. So he's got some substantial experience in the Senate and a little bit more experience in other facets of state government. His big push this year and his big push overall has been focusing on teacher pay. Respecting teachers has been kind of his rallying cry. And as part of his campaign launch, he really talked about his ability to work in a bipartisan manner. Of course, the Indiana legislature does have an overwhelming majority of Republicans. So as a Democrat, he has to work across the aisle. He has to figure out ways to get things that he wants to get done for his community by working with Republicans. And so he was really hammering that point home while also talking about teacher pay and a couple of other things that the other gubernatorial candidates have been talking about, like marijuana, decriminalization or legalization for medical and teacher pay.
Speaking of teacher pay, I understand there's a connection to the superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick. What's that about?
Yeah, so they did this statewide listening tour. They had a few stops all across the state, Evansville, in South Bend or Elkhart, in Muncie, and in Indianapolis. And so for about a month, they went around talking to teachers, literally doing a listening tour. So since then, and he's got a lot of support from teachers, even at his campaign rally, there were teachers there dressed in the Red for Ed t-shirts talking about increases to teacher pay. That listening tour has kind of fueled this idea that maybe the Republican state superintendent, Jennifer McCormick, who announced that she's not running for re-election because of dysfunctional government. That's her word, not mine.
Well, not to mention the fact that it's been brought up many times that should be an appointed position.
Yeah. And that's the reason why it is becoming an appointed position. When Republicans passed legislation to make, I'm sorry, the legislature passed legislation to make that an appointed position, they left her enough room to run for re-election so that she could have 8 years. And she determined after less than two that she was going to be done after four.
Said no thank you.
Yeah. And so that kind of connection has fueled a lot of rumors that McCormick might be angling for the lieutenant governor position on Eddie Melton's campaign.
Really?
Yeah. So there have been a lot of rumors about that. No one's confirmed anything. No one's really addressed anything. But our State House reporter, Brandon Smith, talked to Eddie Melton at that campaign event and asked him, hey, there are these rumors. What's up? And Melton basically said that, McCormick is a proven leader and that it's just too soon to talk about lieutenant governor candidates.
It's literally more than a year away. I can understand his dodge, but yeah. I can also understand the speculation.
Yeah. So it's weird. It's kind of weird and it's kind of interesting in the right crunchy way that I just love.
Can you give us a little bit more info on his competition? You mentioned the names. Who else is seeking this next year's Democratic nomination for governor?
Yeah. So Woody Myers, he's the former health commissioner for the state of Indiana. He's running as a Democrat. And most of his focus is on health and healthcare costs. He spent a lot of time as a healthcare executive after serving in government, and so has kind of tried to position himself as one of those, hey, I know how government works, but I am not a, you know, lifelong politician. And he is really, really focused on, you know, dealing with some of the healthcare gaps in Indiana, especially with maternal and infant mortality, and figuring out better ways to handle health for Hoosiers. And then the other candidate is tech CEO Josh Owens. And he's actually he's the first openly gay Indiana gubernatorial candidate. He's also the CEO of a tech company called SupplyKick. It's an online it's an Indianapolis-based supply retailer. He's never run for office before. He's, you know, very much that political outsider. And his focus has really been on a business approach, figuring out how to make things work no matter who's at the table. And he's really talked about the diversity of voices at the table when making these decisions. So all three candidates, you know, again, have very similar issues. All of them at their core are talking about marijuana decriminalization or legalization for medical. They're talking about teacher pay. They're talking about healthcare costs. But they're all approaching it from a slightly different angle.
Three candidates to look for. And this week we also got a visit from EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler. Where was he?
He was in Indianapolis at an annual environmental conference that was put on by the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. And he was here to announce that the Environmental Protection Agency is loaning Indiana more than $400 million for water infrastructure updates.
Loaning?
Yeah.
Okay. What? So we have to pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of water infrastructure updates?
Indiana has been working for a long time to basically do a lot of repairs. There are pipes in the state that are, you know, 150 years old, that are lead based, that are in desperate need of upgrades, and that's kind of the whole, you know, that's a broad brush for most of Indiana's infrastructure. And so specifically with water infrastructure, a lot of communities across the state have been working toward that. And so this money kind of kicks it to the state government to help local communities, you know, do a buy-in process, but also make sure that everything is replaced at some point.
We'll have to pay it back eventually. But environmental activists have criticized this administration for a lot of reasons. But mm-hmm. What's their biggest concern about the EPA in Indiana?
Yeah, so they were some of the subtext of Wheeler's comments concerned a handful of activists. And this was something actually that Rebecca Thiel, the environmental reporter, told me after she'd reported this story, that a few people that she had talked to who are environmental activists said that they felt like the EPA's job is to make sure that IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, is doing their jobs. And they felt like Wheeler's comments made it sound like the EPA was going to pull back on that and not necessarily be watching everything that IDEM is doing. There was a lot of focus on local control, on state control over environmental regulations. And so environmental activists are concerned that if there's no one watching IDEM, IDEM might not be doing what they're hoping IDEM will do.
Hmm. Okay. And we also keep hearing about these cases of lung injury related to vaping. I understand there was a new development this week in Indiana.
Yes. Actually, yesterday, the Indiana State Department of Health announced that there were two more vaping related deaths in the state of Indiana.
Oh, my goodness.
So that brings that number up to three for the state of Indiana.
Three deaths in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Across the country, that's 26 in 21 states. And so Indiana, the state is actually investigating 75 cases of severe lung injuries. And what was kind of interesting in the comments that the State Department of Health put out was the state health commissioner, Christina Box, actually really highlighted THC products. Now, the CDC has also highlighted THC products in some of their communication with media and with warnings for consumers. They're concerned that that is the through line, that, you know, it's not one single product, it's not one single, company or device. But what seems to be the overlap based on national and regional data is that THC seems to be playing a role, but they don't have any conclusive, findings quite yet.
Finally, the UAW strike still drags on. We talked a little bit last Friday about this. What's new this week?
This week, GM put out a statement basically giving us an update as to what's happening so far with those negotiations. According to GM, what they have put on the table is increased compensation, no increase to out-of-pocket costs for healthcare, and a path to permanent employment for temporary workers. I didn't see the UAW response to that, but it looks like they are starting to get closer, and that GM is really working to communicate with UAW strikers as well. And that, you know, these communities are really rallying together and trying to get through this. Wednesday will be exactly 1 month of the strike. So a lot of things have been tight for a long time. $250 a week for UAW families is not a lot. And that's really impacting these small cities and towns. Places like Roanoke, Kokomo, Bedford, and Marion can't necessarily survive with that kind of deficiency in flow to your, regular businesses, to your retailers, to your shopping things.
Yeah, and so that's kind of a big deal. I mean, but it seems like the needle is sort of moving a little bit. There's some talk.
Yeah, and UAW and GM have been talking back and forth for a while. They seem to be making incremental progress, and that's kind of what GM's statement sort of alluded to, is that they're still working on it. They hear what some of the concerns are. They're working on it. And so that's been the biggest development. But you'll hear more about how these communities are being impacted and things like that from a feature that our business reporter Samantha Horton is putting out that'll probably air on your Indiana Public Broadcasting station sometime in the next week or two.
Love Samantha Horton's work. Lauren Chapman, is our digital producer, the one with the scoop. Thank you so much for catching us up today.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
If you want the news in Indiana, you want to make friends with Lauren. Up next, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Doyle, Associate Professor of History Emeritus at Ball State, and Dr. Mary Munchel Posner, the lead organizer of the BSU Vietnam Moratorium Committee in 1969. We'll hear about a special commemoration that they're planning this afternoon in Muncie. That's 90 seconds away. Stay with us. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. This month commemorates the 50th anniversary of the moratorium to end the war in Vietnam. On October 15, 1969, the marches and teach-ins that took place nationally constituted the largest protest demonstration in U.S. history to that point. Today, Ball State is hosting a Vietnam Moratorium Committee reunion conference to both reunite activists involved at the time and share their experiences with young people. What can today's activists learn from the moratorium's 50 years ago? We're joined by organizers of the conference now to find out. Dr. Michael Doyle is Associate Professor of History Emeritus at Ball State University. Dr. Doyle, thanks for taking the time.
Delighted to be with you today.
And also with us is Dr. Mary Munchel Posner, a clinical psychologist and lead organizer of the BSU Vietnam Moratorium Committee in 1969-1970. Dr. Posner, thank you for joining me as well.
I'm glad to be back.
Dr. Doyle, we're glad to have caught you both. We know that you've been busy. So Ball State is hosting the Vietnam Moratorium Committee 50th Anniversary Commemorative Conference. What is the conference all about?
It's curious that we are the only known event in the United States to commemorate the October 15th moratorium, which, as you noted, was the largest protest demonstration in U.S. history to that point, October of 69. And we conceived of this about a year and a half ago when Mary Posner approached me as an alumna, asking if I would be willing to help as a faculty member in doing more than just bringing together the people who were on campus 50 years ago and part of the anti-Vietnam War movement there. they wanted to do something that would help them get face-to-face with current students on campus who are themselves moved to join together for helping to change the world in some substantive way. And we thought that not just rehashing what happened 50 years ago, but looking at it to extract lessons. This is what worked. Here's what might work for you. Here's what we would advise you to avoid. And here's why. That conversation is something that we really wanted the reunion to culminate in, a conference that would attract more people.
And as you say, it's not just a reunion. It's also to speak with young people today about efforts to peacefully protest. Why is it important to include people of a different generation in this conference?
I'd like to think of that quote that Martin Luther King made popular about the arc of the universe tends to bend towards justice, but it takes a really long time. And that there have been people trying to make the world a better place, presumably since there were people living in social groups ages ago. We saw ourselves back in the 60s as participating in a movement for social change that predated us by generations. We were very cognizant of the fact that some of the things that we were bringing to our rebellion, our protest, were new, but we rested on the shoulders of those who came before. And we really wanted an opportunity to try to find a way to make these experiences relevant to student activists on campus today, as well as townspeople that really don't have a forum to get together to discuss things like this, both rooted in history and focused on the problems that face us today.
Dr. Posner, you were a leader and an organizer of the BSU Vietnam Moratorium Committee in 1969 and 1970. Can you take us back to that time? What was the committee trying to accomplish?
Well, for me personally, what disturbed me most about the war in Vietnam was when I saw pictures of what happened to human beings who were bombed with napalm. And when I saw those pictures, I thought, I can no longer sit back and ignore what the United States is doing to innocent people. So that's what moved me personally. And I found out about the National Vietnam Moratorium Committee being organized. And so as soon as I came to campus in September of 1969, I tried to get a group of like-minded people to organize an event on campus. I just thought, we can't be quiet about this any longer.
How did you find yourself in a leadership position? Was activism something that you had always been involved in, or did this kind of spark it?
Well, I was a member of the Student Senate from my freshman year on. I was a representative at large at the time that I organized the Vietnam Moratorium Committee. And in that capacity, I attended the National Student Congress in Texas. And that was a conference that involved student leaders from all over the United States. And that's where I found out about the Vietnam Moratorium Committee. And a friend of mine from high school was also there, and he told me he was organizing an event at Marion College in Indianapolis, and he told me that I should start one at Ball State, and I demurred. I really didn't know how to do such a thing. I thought I could come back to Ball State and find someone to take the reins, but I could not, and so I stepped up to the plate and started it myself.
So Indianapolis, Muncie, but at the time, this was a nationwide movement, right?
That's right. And there was a national committee. So I got in touch with the national committee, and they sent me information about what other people were doing. And they provided us with buttons with the famous dove on them and leaflets and kind of gave us ideas about how to get organized. It wasn't much. We were pretty much on our own, but that's what got us started.
So what was happening locally in Muncie? How were these protests received?
Well, they were not received well. I would say that we organized something every month from October through April, and month after month, we tried to get a permit to rally at the courthouse in Muncie. And month after month, we were denied. In fact, we found out that the veterans organization in Muncie had a blanket order that they wanted to use the courthouse plaza whenever we requested it. Obviously, this was not the right way to go about things. So we persisted, and eventually we were able to demonstrate at the courthouse. Most memorably, in December of 1969, we demonstrated in front of the plaza since we couldn't get the plaza itself. And the veterans were there in force and fired rifles over our heads during our protest in December. So that tells you something about our reception in Muncie. On the other hand, in January of 1970, a church in South Muncie organized a birthday celebration for Martin Luther King and invited us to join them in that. And so that part of the community was very much with us.
And your protests even attracted national news coverage. What was it like? What was that? And what was it like being under that kind of spotlight?
Well, it was a surprise when a reporter came to interview me from the Washington Post. I wasn't quite prepared for that, and we ended up being on the front page of the Washington Post. And because of that article, NBC News found out about what we were doing, and they came to Muncie, and they did a five-part series about what was going on in Muncie, which, as you may know, was known as Middletown, USA. So that's why Muncie was focused on. We were considered to be representative of what the Middle America, the flyover zone, was all about. So they spent a lot of time on campus, and then eventually when they were ready to film, they sent out Dean Brailis, who was a correspondent. And I remember that he interviewed me for about an hour at the office of the Vietnam Moratorium Committee. And out of that, there ended up being a six-minute segment. So that was interesting to find out how the media worked.
What advice do you have for activists today that ask you how to maybe effectively organize and have their voices heard?
Well, my own experience is that you have to choose a cause that you are personally really behind, because it's very hard work and there are some unpleasant consequences to putting yourself out front. So you have to be sure that you choose a cause that lines up with your own heart. And once you do that, you reach out and find other people like yourself. It wasn't that easy back then. We had to use phones with cords, and we had to use letters that we mailed in the mailbox. We didn't have Facebook or Twitter or any other social media. So I think students would probably have an easier time reaching out to each other now. So I'd say start with a cause that means something to you. I think the students from Parkland are a good example of what this generation can do now. We could never have organized that massively in such a short time back then, but they showed us the way. And I think Greta Thunberg is another example of how one person can have an idea, and through her own, she was so committed to it that week by week, she attracted other people to her cause. And I think most recently, 4 million people were involved in a demonstration about climate change. So they are the examples of how to get things done now. So I would look to them for how to do it.
Dr. Doyle, what parallels do you see between the protests and marches during the Vietnam War and the protests that we see today?
Let me pick up on something that Mary just said about the singularity of the Vietnam War, which tended to absorb a lot of the attention of activists 50 years ago. It was an outgrowth of the civil rights movement, and many of the people that became active in the anti-war movement did so immediately following their activism within civil rights. And, for example, our keynote speaker, David Harris, is somebody who was in the South. He came back to his campus at Stanford, ran for and was surprisingly elected president of his student body. And when he did, that was coincided with when LBJ decided to escalate American involvement in the war and insert U.S. troops into combat on behalf of the South Vietnamese. And many of the people that had been working on behalf of civil rights at that time turned their attention to trying to affect U.S. policy in Vietnam. What I wanted to point out about that is that the struggle for civil rights that began with the Black freedom struggle eventually in the 60s developed into concerns over American Indians, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, and women, and that each of those movements absorbed people's attention while they were still involved with other causes like opposing the war in Vietnam. So people tended to refer to themselves, at least through the end of the 60s, as part of the movement, as though it were a singular thing. But it had many different fronts, and probably the largest that attracted people's attention after about April of 1965 was the Vietnam War. So lessons for activists today would include looking at your vision of social change. If you're focusing on, for example, climate change, what are the root causes? How can people be affected in their day-to-day lives to change something that collaboratively could lead in the direction of a wider change? And then think your way through to how you can persuade people to see things the way you do, and perhaps also take that next step into doing lifestyle changes or organizing together in a larger group to begin agitating for fulfilling that vision of social change. Pretty much every one of the movements of the 1960s era has a continuation into the present, although I'm not sure that activists who are on campus today or younger people throughout the community who aren't in college have a historical time depth to see how what they're interested in links up with the concerns of, say, 50 years ago.
You've been teaching history for a long time. Do you notice changes in what matters to young people or how they choose to express their political grievances?
Well, one of the exercises that I've done in my I every year teach at least once or twice a course on the 1960s, and also I regularly have taught a course on the U.S. Vietnam War. And I always have an oral history exercise in that course where students are required to go out and interview somebody who was an eyewitness to or a participant in the history that we're studying through our books and films and the rest of it. And I've noticed that generationally, they went from interviewing their parents and uncles and aunts to grandparents and even great-grandparents now. And with that, they're able to situate themselves through their family line in things that are more abstract to them. They're fascinated by how many millions of people turned out to work on behalf of the peace movement or work on behalf of the expansion of civil rights for all Americans and more equality and justice. But one of the things that they're surprised about, and it strikes me as worthy of pursuing, is that the generation of students who are on campus today are as large as the baby boom generation was. So both generations have the numbers. But there was something that brought together the baby boom generation with more of a unitary identity and more open to opposing the status quo and working towards a collaborative vision of social change than students today. So I try to get them to think through the historical problems through the study of the 1960s and then try to figure out from that what could be tools in their toolkit that might be brought to bear on helping organize themselves today.
Dr. Posner, what's it been like to reunite with those people you protested with 50 years ago?
It's been really quite emotional. People have shared stories with me that I didn't even actually know at the time. One of my fellow protesters reminded me that when we marched our first march in October of 1969, that when we walked down Fraternity Row, there were fraternity guys in the trees who spit on us. Now, personally, I must have blocked that out, so that kind of shook me up a little bit. Other people reminded me that they still have the spirit that we had back then and are still working in their own communities for similar causes. So it's been nice to see the spirit. We may be older and have different color hair now, but inside, we are still who we were back then.
Well, I was going to add something to two things that Mary said, including her just last statement and one earlier about back in 1969 and 70, how the local veterans community had responded to the anti-war protests. We were never anti-veteran in the 60s in the anti-war movement, at least the people that I was organized with. In fact, what struck me was when we did marches and demonstrations, veterans who had come out against the war were always carrying the flag and in the forefront. So I never understood when people use that term spit upon veteran. I never witnessed that, and I've done a lot of oral histories with Vietnam veterans, and I know that they recount that they were treated poorly by some protesters when they returned stateside from their service in Vietnam. But I would have to say that for people that are concerned today, several of the people that are involved in our conference and on our steering committee are themselves veterans of the war in Vietnam. When they came back, they felt like they needed to dedicate their time to opposing the war, and that they could speak with more authority than people who were merely civilians and hadn't seen the elephant, as they used to say about people in combat.
Ball State is hosting a Vietnam Moratorium Committee reunion conference this afternoon on campus. Our guests have been Dr. Michael Doyle, Associate Professor of History Emeritus at Ball State University. Dr. Doyle, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Also, Dr. Mary Munchel Posner, clinical psychologist and lead organizer of the BSU Vietnam Moratorium Committee in 1969. Dr. Posner, thank you for joining us as well.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
And up next, we explore some of the curious places and strange history of our glorious capital city. Author Ashley Petrie joins us next to talk about her new book, Secret Indianapolis, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. We'll learn about the dirty and dangerous prank played here on a U.S. president. And who could forget the great squirrel invasion of 1822? Well, we did, but she dug it back up. We'll talk about that and more next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In, back in 90 seconds.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Like every city, ours is full of secrets. Our show is all about Indiana, so we do our show in the biggest and literally the most centrally located city in the state, Indianapolis. I've lived and worked here for over a decade, which has not nearly been long enough to discover all of its secrets. Then I found out about this new book and discovered that I haven't even scratched the surface. Secret Indianapolis, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure has been out for less than a month, and its author, Ashley Petrie, is with us now.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
First of all, thank you for writing this.
Oh, my pleasure. I had a lot of fun doing the research, and I found out all sorts of things myself.
I love books like this. Not only books of local interest, but curiosity guides in general. I'm a big fan. What made you write it?
Well, my first book was called 100 Things to Do in Indianapolis Before You Die. And it was, as it's in the title, Things to Do. And so I didn't really have a chance to share the weird, quirky stories about Indianapolis history and things like that that unfortunately got left on the cutting room floor. So it was a pleasure to be able to finally share all those stories.
So these are sort of, this is kind of the freak show of that
list.
Yes,
exactly.
let's kind of dig into it. I don't want to scoop your book because I want people to look at it and pick it up. But let's talk about some of the more interesting things in the book.
Sure.
Where can you find artwork made of human hair?
So actually, the Indiana State Museum has a whole display of artwork made of human hair. It was very popular in the Victorian era because it was a way to sort of memorialize someone by saving a part of their body. And hair was the part that would last. So they would make these beautiful wreaths and bouquets and all sorts of things out of the hair of their dead loved ones. And sometimes their live loved ones, too. And they would make a whole family tree of it.
And that wasn't creepy at the time.
Well, no, it was very common. There were, you know, guides, how-to guides published on how to do this. It was called Victorian hair work. It was very mainstream at the time. It seems creepy to us now.
There was a beverage in Indianapolis that was made, I think it's in the 40s, started in the 40s, mm-hmm. Chocola.
Yes.
And you can't find it anymore.
No, it is no longer produced. A couple years ago, the trademark expired on that trademark, and the owner of Rocola 1950s Cafe decided he was going to snatch it up for a song. So you can now get Chocola there. It's made on site, and it is the only place in the world where it's still possible to get a Chocola.
Does it taste the same as the old stuff?
Well, I'm unfortunately too young for the old stuff, but I hear that it does taste the same. And I know that when they recreated the recipe, they were trying to be very faithful to it.
What about the Millionaire Row mansions built by the founders of IMS, the Speedway?
Right. So the Speedway was founded in 1909, and the first Indy 500 ran in 1911. And that same year, a couple of the founders of the Speedway decided that they all wanted to be neighbors. So they built a couple of mansions and purchased one existing mansion on the campus of what is now Marion University. And those buildings have over the years been subsumed into campus. So the Allison Mansion is where the president's office is at Marion. There's another that houses the admissions department. So there's this huge legacy of the Speedway on the Marion University campus that most people just aren't aware of.
My wife's a graduate of Marion. I didn't know about this.
Well, there you go.
She probably did. She probably just hasn't told me, or maybe I forgot. What about the Great Squirrel Invasion of 1822?
This is a true story, and it sounds very funny to us now, but actually it was rather devastating back in 1822. In the year 1822, Indianapolis is newborn, just a year old, and farmers are just starting to put in their first crops of corn and things like that. Unfortunately, in 1822, the trees didn't produce enough nuts to keep the squirrels full. They were basically starving to death. So the squirrels of the Midwest went on a rampage, almost like a plague of locusts across the Midwest, eating up all the corn and other crops they could find. And that included, unfortunately, many of the early crops in Indianapolis. There's a report from Calvin Fletcher, one of the early settlers here, that he shot 250 of them in his field without making even a tiny dent in their numbers. And there are other settlers who reported that they were up all day shooting squirrels and up all night making new bullets. Thousands upon thousands of these squirrels came through.
That is staggering.
It is.
Like when I hear that, that's a number. Are there any estimates as to how many there might have been?
Not that I've heard, but Calvin Fletcher did say that 10 squirrels could do as much damage as one loose hog. So if that gives you a sense of perspective, they were incredibly damaging.
What about the dirty prank that was pulled on a former president here in town?
Oh, this is one of my favorite stories from this book, and it's one that I had never heard of before I started doing the research. And actually, when my husband was looking through this book for the first time, he said, "Listen to this cool thing I just heard about Martin Van Buren." And I said, "Yeah, I know. I wrote that book." He got really excited because he's a history buff. But here's the story about Martin Van Buren. In the early years of Indianapolis, we were hugely dependent on U.S. 40, the national road. The railroad hadn't arrived yet. We didn't have any navigable rivers that we could use for trade. So anything that came in or out of Indianapolis came on the national road. It was also an absolutely terrible road. Huge ruts and tree stumps and all sorts of problems. People used to tie themselves to their wagons so they wouldn't fall off when they went into the ruts. So we desperately, desperately wanted the federal funding to improve that road. But during Martin Van Buren's presidency, Congress cut off funding for the national road, and the ownership and responsibility was transferred to the states. So here we are, hugely dependent on this road that now is not going to be maintained to the level we need it to be maintained. And people sort of held a grudge against Martin Van Buren for that. A couple years later, he's out of office. He's trying to drum up support for a second presidency. And he ironically does a campaign tour along the National Road. And when he gets to Indianapolis and then to Plainfield, the people of Plainfield decide they're going to show him what they cost, or what he cost them in terms of this road. So they bribed his driver to go careening down a giant hill and run over some elm roots that were at the bottom of the hill. And the driver did this. His bribe was a $5 silk hat. So basically, he intentionally caused an accident with Martin Van Buren's carriage. When he went over the elm tree's roots, Martin Van Buren went flying out the door and went head over heels into a puddle of mud, which everyone thought was just delightful. And so that elm that the carriage had run over became known as the Van Buren Elm. And the tree is still there.
It's still there?
I'm sorry, the tree was still there for a long time, and then they put a plaque next to it when it finally died, and then they planted another elm in the identical spot. So you can go still see the spot. It's just the tree didn't last.
What? Somebody could have been killed. The president could have been killed.
Yeah, he could have, but as it stands, it was a pretty funny prank and very appropriate.
There was a place in town where Hollywood celebrities would come, mm-hmm. and It was called Tuckaway.
Yes.
What was this? Where was this?
So this was a small home in Meridian Place, and it was sort of tucked away in the trees. So that's why it was called Tuckaway. And it was owned by George and Nellie Meyer. And this was in the 20s. George was a fashion designer, and Nellie was a palm reader, but she didn't think of it in a sort of paranormal sense. She thought of it as a science, that you could read the lines of the hands and things like that and make scientific determinations about someone's personality and future and that kind of thing. George and Nellie were very well known by all the Hollywood celebrities, by Einstein, by Walt Disney, by Eleanor Roosevelt. All sorts of people would come through and have stop when they were in Indianapolis and have a party with the Meyers. They were famous for throwing these parties where George Gershwin would just spontaneously give a performance, or Isadora Duncan would just dance across the living room.
Wow.
Yes. And on top of all that, you know, Nellie's over here reading all of their palms and making impressions of their hands. She eventually put all those in a book called Lion's Paws. And you can actually see the handprints of some of these famous people. For example, Amelia Earhart's handprints are in there and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. The story about Tuckaway that may or may not be true is that in 1942, Carol Lombard was in town to help raise money for war bonds, because she's originally from Indiana. And she knew Nellie Meyer. George was dead at this point, but she knew Nellie, and she stopped by Tuckaway to get her palm read. And Nellie didn't really like to give future predictions. She was very focused on, you know, right now, what can I learn from your personality, from your hands? But allegedly, she looked at Carol Lombard's hand and said, "You're in grave danger. You must not travel for the next couple of days." And Carol Lombard sort of brushed it off. She was on her way home the next day, and her plane crashed, and she died. So there is this story that Carol Lombard's death was predicted based on Nellie Meyer's palm reading.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Too creepy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about forgotten Hoosier heroes. There was a police officer who was murdered.
Yes.
But the murder was ignored.
Completely ignored. This was in 1922, and the officer's name was William Whitfield. He was an African-American police officer. He had been assigned to patrol a white neighborhood, and there were a lot of people who did not want that to happen. And so the speculation is that he was assassinated to send a message about that decision. He was buried in Crown Hill with no gravestone, no ceremony whatsoever. His death never made the front page. It was completely hushed up because the city's politics at that time were very dominated by the KKK, and they didn't really want it to be big news, so it wasn't. So unfortunately, he went without the honors he deserved for many, many decades. But in the late 90s, the police historian wrote about William Whitfield for the department newsletter. And a couple of officers said, "We need to fix this. We need to give him at least a gravestone." So they thought it might take weeks, maybe months. They raised the money for his gravestone in 3 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. So when the gravestone was ready and placed, they did have a memorial service for William Whitfield. He got the 21-gun salute and all those typical things. So it took a long time, but we did finally recognize his service. And his tombstone now says, "First African-American Indianapolis Police Department officer to be killed in the line of duty."
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So that was a dark time in Indiana's history.
It was.
But let's talk about sort of a resolution to that time. The woman who single-handedly destroyed the KKK's hold on Indiana politics.
Yes. So there was a woman named Madge Oberholzer. She lived in Irvington. She was a state employee. A couple of blocks away from her, also in Irvington, was D.C. Stevenson, who was the grand dragon of the KKK. And who basically chose the Indiana governor, who chose the mayors around the state, because he had so much influence that he could just tell people who to vote for. And so he had a lot of political cronies, and he thought he was above the law. So he took a liking to Madge. And when she refused him several times, he actually kidnapped her instead and assaulted her on a train on the way up to Chicago. She took some cleaning tablets, not to commit suicide, but to make him take her home. And ultimately, he did take her back home. But she never recovered from the wounds he had inflicted on her. And about a month later, she passed away. But before that, she decided she was going to tell what had happened. And of course, the crimes that had happened weren't ones that people really felt comfortable talking about at that time. They often went unreported. But she gave a witness statement that was so clear and so detailed that it's still used in law schools to this day as an example of a really good witness statement. And it was enough to put D.C. Stevenson in prison for murder. And he did not think that that was going to happen. He got frustrated that his political cronies hadn't come to his aid. So he decided to start spilling all the dirt he had on all of those people, which was a lot of people. And so all these politicians who had been affiliated with the KKK resigned or were not reelected and that sort of thing. So really, Madge single-handedly brought down the KKK's hold on Indiana politics.
A martyr for all of us today.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about some of the art, weird art around town. Now, there's one on our parking garage. There's one on a road sign near where I live. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Record Face. What is it? and where did it come from?
Well, I can only partially answer your question because Record Face is, it's vandalism or it's guerrilla art, depending on how you choose to look at it. But the artist is anonymous. So Record Face is it's a face made out of a vinyl record. It has guitar picks for teeth and it has cassette tape hair and it has a bicycle reflector for its single eye. And when it's installed, it's listening to a little MP3 player. Those usually get stolen pretty quickly, so you usually won't see one with the MP3 player.
I think I've only seen one with the mm-hmm. MP3 player, and then soon after it was gone.
Yes, and sometimes if it's maybe up very high, it'll last a little bit longer. But these, there are dozens and dozens of them that have appeared all over the city. The artist is completely anonymous. There was some controversy about them because one of those record faces was placed on the Kurt Vonnegut mural on Mass Ave. And the artist who had painted that mural didn't appreciate that. She thought that her work had been compromised. So that was removed. And that caused a stir. And the Indianapolis Star wrote about it. And this anonymous artist wrote into the Star and said, "Oops, I'm really sorry. I won't do that again. You're right. That was wrong. I won't put it on other people's artwork anymore. But I just want to create an intersection of art and music and the Indiana landscape. And that's what I'm trying to do." So it is a mystery. We still don't know who it is, but I just think it's fun because once you hear about Record Face, then you're always going to see it.
It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I appreciate Record Face. It's kind of a weird Indianapolis thing.
Yep.
But there's a machine along the cultural trail that makes smells?
Yes. Specifically, it's rose-scented. It's in the alley next to the metro. And it's a scent machine that's embedded in the sidewalk with a grate over it, a decorative grate. And yes, it releases the scent of roses because right next door was where there used to be a lingerie factory from the 20s to the 50s. And the scent of roses is supposed to convey that same sense of luxury and intimacy. So if you're on the cultural trail and you suddenly smell roses in that area, you're not having a stroke. It is an artwork that most people walk right over.
There's a park in town that's so obscure nobody knows how to spell its name.
Yes.
Are you not talking about a holiday park where people
no.
subtract an L?
No. No, this is – it's Woolen's Gardens of Birds and Botany. It's technically part of the Indianapolis Parks Department, but they don't know how to spell it because they don't even know how to spell they've misspelled it according to the name of the donor. But basically, it's in the middle of nowhere, sort of just south of Skiles Test Nature Park, and there's no way to get to it. It's across the river, and if you want to get to it, you're going to have to take a canoe with you.
I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I used to hike Skiles Test all the time.
Yep.
And I thought there's a thing over there, but yeah. I can't
yes,
go.
No. When he gave the park area to the city, he said. He stipulated that it had to be preserved in its natural state, and it has been. But there was some plan at some point to put a bridge into that area, and the bridge never happened. So it's basically just this wilderness that's very hard to access. But technically, it's a park. You can go walk through it.
If you are curious about any of the things that you've heard about today and you want to know more, and there are dozens of other things in the book, you need to pick up Secret Indianapolis, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. Ashley Petrie, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You're going to be at Goose the Market tomorrow at 11 o'clock for a book signing.
Yes, I'll be there from 11 to 1 signing books, and I'd be happy to share all the other stories that I have assembled in this book because I'm really excited about them.
Thank you, Ashley.
My pleasure.
And you can find our show wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for All in Indiana. Next time, we'll talk with Ryan Mears, the new Marion County prosecutor, about his decision to stop criminally charging people for small amounts of marijuana. Join us Monday at 1 for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.